the question that we're looking at today is, seriously, the Bible is good history? Seriously. And by that, what we're trying to do is to interact with the response that a lot of people have when Christians are talking to them and they're saying, these are the things that Jesus did. These are the things that Jesus said. And then they may not want to believe that. I think in our society, it's now just the background noise to assume that the Bible's not right, for whatever reason. And that's what we're looking at in these talks. And I think part of the reason, one of these reasons is that it's just historically not true. There's no evidence for this. I don't know where you stand on that. It may be that you actually agree with that and you've thought about it. But I suspect that for most people, it may be a view that they hold, that the Bible's not true, but they've never actually thought about it. Again, I don't know where you stand, and I'm not trying to make that judgment on you, but I think that that's just what I observe in our society, that people just assume that what's in the Bible isn't true, but they don't actually know why they assume that. Well, I want to answer that question today to look at the Bible from an historical point of view, and we're going to be asking five typical historical questions that historians would ask of any document. But I'm going to be asking them of the Bible in particular. I'm only going to be doing the New Testament part of the Bible, that is the part that explicitly talks about Jesus, just for the sake of time. The first point I want to look at, actually before we look at the questions, is this book about Jesus actually even claiming to be telling us the truth? Because what we're asking really is, does this describe real people and real events? And it's important to know, is the Bible even wanting to claim that? So have a look at your first quote there. You'll need your outline. Have a look at it there. It says, "We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the coming, about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." For me, that verse, and there's a whole range of others which I've put the references there, really capture what Christians and what the Bible is presenting to you, that yes, indeed, what it's putting forward is the real person of Jesus, and that these are the things he really did and really said. So the Bible is actually trying to make that claim. I think it's a reasonable question for someone to ask, though, is the Bible history, because it is an ancient book. It's 2,000 years old, at the latest part of it. And so it's a fair question to ask. And so that's why, I'm glad you're here, because we're going to look at the five common questions that historians would ask of anything and apply them to the New Testament. So let's have a look at these then. The first one is going to be, who wrote it? Then how many independent sources do we have? Is it a coherent history? Does it fit in with the rest of known history? And do the events which follow match the event that was claimed to happen? And they're sort of your classic historical questions that people ask. Let's have a look at the first one. Who wrote the New Testament? Now, this is an important question to ask, because when historians are considering a piece of information, they want to get as close back to the original as they can. So if you were to hear someone talking about Jesus and he lived 600 years after Jesus, okay, you could listen to him. But if you were to listen to someone who was at the time of Jesus, well, then that's a bit different, isn't it? And it's just that simple observation that the people who are nearer are certainly in a good position to know and to be consulted. And so when we come to the New Testament, what we find is that it's actually written by people at the time of Jesus. All of the New Testament documents that we have in the Bible regarding Jesus were written before the end of the first century. It's a little hard to date them exactly, and there are different methods that people use to date them. Some we can date quite specifically, others we can't date that specifically. But we know that they're all within the first century, if not well before the end of the first century. And many of them were actually by the companions of Jesus. They're actually the very his own disciples. They were eyewitnesses of Jesus. They were people who traveled with Jesus, were taught by Jesus, and were actually sent out by him. And so they're not just anybody. They're actually the people in the know who wrote these things. And so just from a historical point of view, these are actually really good people to listen to. These were Jesus' own students. These were the ones who learned from him and wrote it down. Now, we actually know that Jesus had disciples from sources even outside of the Bible. So if you have a look at the next quote there from the Babylonian Talmud, Yeshua is a way of saying Jesus in Hebrew. And it said Yeshua had five disciples, Mattai, Nachtai, Netzah, Buni, and Todah. And so it mentions his five disciples. Now you might say, didn't he have 12? I'm not too worried about that. I'm not too worried that this one says five, because this is by someone from the outside of Jesus' group. This is not a Christian source. This is a Jewish non-Christian source observing the Christians. And so I wouldn't expect them to know all of his disciples and how many exactly had. But it certainly is a reference to Yeshua and that he had disciples. What we actually find as we continue through history is that the early histories that were written talk about these disciples as well. And so we have evidence that Jesus had disciples, that he sent them out from both the Bible, from non-Jewish Christian sources, Jewish non-Christian sources, and from general history. And again, a point I brought up last night, for Jesus to have disciples and to send them out to tell people about him was actually quite normal. That's what Buddha had done, that's what other teachers have done. And so for Jesus' disciples to do this for him is actually quite a normal thing for a student to do of his master. We mustn't think that that's an unusual thing when it happens. Sometimes people will claim that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, are anonymous. And they'll say, well, you know, it doesn't say from Matthew, the apostle of Jesus. And so what are we to make of that when it says, well, they're actually not eyewitness accounts because they're anonymous? Well, it's true that the name of the author is not specifically mentioned in the introduction to the document, but that doesn't make it anonymous. To be anonymous means that you actually withhold your identity in such a way that people cannot find out. So if you're on the internet, you know how most people on the internet are anonymous. They use some name, you know, Jack the Ripper or whatever it's going to be. They have some name for themselves, Stevie 665, whatever it's going to be. And it's not really who they are. And you know that when you're on the web that people actually are anonymous there. But that's not what these men are doing. They've actually... They are well known to their communities, and that they've written these and they've given them to their community. So just because their name's on it doesn't automatically mean it's anonymous. We need to take that into account. People who deny the authorship and say, well, it wasn't written by Jesus' disciples, really need to provide good evidence for this. And most of the time it's just an assumption that that they couldn't have done this. But as I've tried to stress, it's quite normal for a student to write down the teaching and pass on the teaching of their master. So there's no reason for us to doubt it. Some people will say that, well, okay, the disciples of Jesus may well have done this, but we can't trust their history because they're religious. And that's one of the big words today, isn't it? It's a religious thing, and so you can't trust it. Now, it is true that these books teach theology and Christian practice, but just because something is religious doesn't mean it's not history. And historians understand this. Every piece of information, every piece of history or information that we get is written from a particular perspective. And historians take that into account. You can't actually get something that's written from no perspective. And so we just can't write it off because it's written with a religious theme to it. Either way, we can ask further questions to test the history that they give us to see whether or not it's reliable. Another thing we need to look at is the fact how unusual it is to have such early accounts for Jesus? We need to realize how early it is. For instance, when it comes to Muhammad's life, the first written account we have of his life is about, I don't know if I've got my details here, it's about 125 years after his life. There are individual snippets from before there, but the first complete book is about 125 years. And even that one we've only got on a recension that has been made, and that's 175 years after Muhammad. And that's in the 7th century AD. When it comes to Buddha, Buddhism's quite popular. The first account we have of Buddha's life is 350 years after Buddha. It's a long time. When it comes to Jesus, it's 15 years. 15 years. It's actually very, very close. It's with the letter to the Galatians, which we can quite well date to about 48 AD. Jesus died and was raised 33 AD. So it's only 15 years. So the conclusion I want to make to this first question, who wrote the New Testament? Who wrote these accounts of Jesus? Well, it was the eyewitnesses. They were the right people at the right time. And they are recognized as the oldest documents that we have on Jesus' life. What we have in the Bible, you know, it may just seem so routine, so, well, it's just always been there, but it's actually the oldest documents that we do have. I want to move on to the second question now. How many independent sources do we have? This is a second question that historians will say because, okay, the New Testament may be an old document, it might be the earliest one that we have, but is it just one voice telling us about Jesus? What historians like and what courts of law like is to have multiple witnesses to something. And so you can understand that if there's an event and several people tell you about that event from different perspectives in different ways, that adds to the certainty of that event, doesn't it? Because it's not just one person, it's a range of people. Well, what do we find when we look at the Bible, when we look at the New Testament? Well, what we find is that the New Testament is full of independent sources that tell us about Jesus. It's not just one person telling us about Jesus. It's actually about 8 different people. So there's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who are different writers of the different Gospels. But when we even look at, particularly Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when we look at these Gospels, we see that those Gospels have come from other sources before them. And scholars have got certain ways of identifying these. And so these Gospels actually represent more testimonies than just the testimony of the final book itself. There's also the letters of Peter, the letters of Paul, and of James. Now, how do we know that they're independent sources? Well, we know they are because of the way they speak, the way they explain things. For instance, in the Gospel, Jesus is often calling himself the Son of Man. Yet the Apostle Paul never calls him that. And neither does James or Peter. The way that James talks about the Gospel is, he never uses the word Gospel, he uses the word the law that gives freedom. But Paul will talk about the Gospel. And so each one talks about it in their own particular way, describing the same events of Jesus, but in their own unique way. And it's by this that scholars are able to sort of tease out what are the different strands of it. And so what we find is that the Bible has at least 8 different sources which testify to the life of Jesus. Now that is actually very good. We need to understand, it's very good. It's not just the Bible says. It's not just that. But there are 8 different testimonies, 8 different witnesses in the New Testament testifying to Jesus. In fact, the type of evidence that we find is the type of evidence you would expect if Jesus was true. Okay? So the type of evidence we have in the Bible is the type of evidence you would expect if Jesus did was the teacher he said he was at that time, and he was written up by his disciples. You would have this type of information. All right, let's move on. The third question, is it a coherent history? Now, what I mean by that is, when we look at the story of Jesus, is it just bits and pieces all thrown together in sort of like a muddled mess? Or does it actually read as a whole story? Can we make sense of it? Is he someone that you can read this and say, no, that this is a real person who had a history, we can read it, we can make sense of it here? Now, the overwhelming answer to that is yes. The Bible is, and its account of Jesus is, coherent history. It contains all the locations, the events that happened, who was involved. It has the details that we need there. Now, that's not to say that it's just straightforward. So it's not always straightforward. Like any history, there can be difficulties to this. In fact, one of the things that makes the Bible so good is also something that can make it a little difficult to put its history together sometime. You see, if you've read one of the Gospels, and I hope you have, you'll notice that it's full of details. It will talk about Jesus went from this place to that place. Sometimes it even tells you how far it was, how many kilometres, and sometimes it'll even tell you whether he was going uphill or downhill. That is a phenomenal amount of detail. It tells you towns, cities, kings, dates. It gives you the different groups of people who were around. And so when you've got a lot of information, fitting it all together is actually harder. The more details you get, the harder it is sometimes to fit it together. But that's actually a good thing. You mustn't think, because I've got details and they may not fit as easy as I'd like them to, you mustn't think that's a bad thing. One of the things I do is read the Quran. And one of the things I've been struck with the Quran is how it just has so few details. It, like, when it talks about Jesus, it never says what city he was in. It never says who his disciples were. It just has Jesus talking. And there's basically no other detail. But it's not like that when you read the Bible. When you read the Bible, it is full of details. Now, I'd like us all to have a look at these two references here. And this is a bit of an exercise from Matthew 20 and from Luke 18. Can you see those there where it says, as Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho? So can you read those two references and then just tell me what you notice? Thanks. Okay, so have people had a chance to read that? Okay, so anyone want to have a go at something? Not Nathan. Anyone else want to have a go? There's two people in one, so I'll just read out. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. So that's from Matthew 20, 29 to 30. But in Luke 18, 35 to 38, we read, as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He called out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. So what are some comments you want to have about those two events, which seem to be the same event, but recorded in different Gospels? Okay, so in the first one, it says he's leaving Jericho, and in the second one, it says he was approaching Jericho. Okay. Yep. And what was the other one someone brought up? Tyrone, did you bring one up? So in the first one, it says two blind men, and in the other one, it just said a blind man. Now, I guess that's the type of thing that you see on the documentaries on TV, and they'll show that type of thing and say, look at this, look at that. It's, you know, the Bible, you can't trust it, it's bad history, look at that, it's contradiction. I want to suggest, though, that you need to be careful before you come to that conclusion. I'll give you a couple of bits of information. First of all, on one where it says there were two men and the other where it says there was a man, that's not a contradiction. That's just a bit more detail. On the first one, it's telling you how many, two. The next one's just saying a blind man. If it said there was one blind man, yes, I would see that as a difficulty. But when it just says a blind man called out, it's not even trying to tell you if there's one, two, three, whatever. So the numbers there, that's just part of eyewitness testimony, isn't it? One person says two, another person says a man called out. He's not telling you that there was a group of them. What about with Jesus going into Jericho or coming out of Jericho? Now that sounds a bit harder. But it's also worthwhile knowing that at this time, there were actually two Jerichos next to each other. There was an old Jericho, which was fairly run down, and about a kilometer away, there was the new Jericho that the Herodians had built. Now, I'm not saying this is the answer, but it's quite possible. And you can imagine between the towns, there would have been a road and traffic going between them. I'm not saying this is the answer, but it could well be that both of these are exactly right, and that he's coming out and he's going in to old Jericho and new Jericho. Now, I just bring this up because people love to stand in judgment of the Bible. People love to think that they can point the finger, that they know all the details. And it may actually be that you just don't know enough details and that the Bible is far more accurate than you're in a position to judge. So, is it a coherent story? Yes, it is. My fourth point is, does it fit in with known history? Now, why ask this question? Well, because the Bible's not the only history we have. We've got lots of documents from the first century. Here's a book we have from the first century, Josephus. Look at the size of it. It's written by a Jewish man around the year 90 AD, I think around 90 AD. And so he writes a history of the Jewish people from just a short time after Jesus. And we've got many other books as well from that time. And so from that, historians consult these and they get a general picture of the world at that time, and they try to be as specific as the sources will allow them to. And so the question comes, when we actually look at Jesus as he's portrayed in the New Testament, does he actually fit into the broader sweep of history that we have from other sources as well? And obviously the answer would be, if what the Bible has is true history, then it should fit in to the general picture that we have. It may give us more specific details, but it still should fit in. Well, how does the Bible go in this regard? Well, overwhelmingly, yes. Overwhelmingly, yes. I want to look at 3 points here. The first one is just in a general sense, in that I said to you before that the Bible has specific names, specific peoples, distances, all that type of stuff. It talks about the language that people spoke. It speaks about the kings who were in charge at the time, the geography, the customs. All of those things that we have in the New Testament actually correspond to what we know from general history and from books like Josephus and others of the area that Jesus lived in. And so again, when you're just reading that there was this particular group of people and they did this, you might think, well, that's nothing. But to a historian in the Bible, that's something, because you've at least said the name, you're making a historical claim. And the Bible is very good in that detail. Now, we can get more specific, though, because it's not just that Jesus does fit into the general times and places and languages and customs of as the Bible records it, but we also have specific references to Jesus outside of the Bible. Now, I'm going to quote now from Josephus. This is a non-Christian Jewish writer from the first century. And so we actually have specific references to Jesus, which I thought we could look at. Let's look at this first one here. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. Many people from among the Jews and from other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who became his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah of whom the prophets have recounted. Or here's another one. This is Josephus writing, and it's just an incidental comment that he makes here. He says, "So he, King Agrippa, assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James." And so it's just an incidental thing that there's this Jesus called the Christ, and he was the brother of Jesus. And of course, we know about James from within the Bible itself. Again, I've already read to you that reference from the Babylonian Talmud about Jesus having five disciples and mentioning them. Or we can look at the next one from the Babylonian Talmud. Yeshua was hanged on Passover Eve. 40 days previously, the herald had cried, "He is being led out for stoning because he has practiced sorcery and led Israel astray and enticed them to apostasy. Whosoever has anything to say in his defense, let him come forward and declare it." As nothing was brought forward in his defense, he was hanged on Passover Eve. So you can see that's a very different tradition to what we have in the Bible, isn't it? But it's the times, it's all those types of things. Or there's the Roman historian Tacitus, who wrote across the first and second century, and he writes that Christians derived their name from a man called Christ, who during the reign of Emperor Tiberius had been executed by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. The deadly superstition, that is Christianity, a deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out afresh, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but also in the city of Rome. Now you see, a lot of those references I've given you, they're actually hostile to Christianity. But they testify that Jesus was known as for a miracle worker. One calls him, you know, a sorcery, what he was doing. You can see that they may be hostile to Christianity, but Jesus is there, isn't he? He's there. He's on the map. Now, how am I going for time? I think I've got time for this. So to conclude this section, we can see that there's Christian, Jewish, and Roman independent sources. They record that Jesus existed, that his brothers had served as head of the churches, that he had disciples, that he was known as a miracle worker, that he died by crucifixion, that his disciples claimed he was resurrected, and that Christianity started in Judea. So this is all from just outside of the Bible, we can gather that. Okay, now that's easy. What about the miracles? What about the miracles? Well, I thought we could just quickly look at these two references, because you might say, okay, that he existed is one thing, but what about the miracles he does? Well, we've actually got a miracle reported in the Bible and out of the Bible as well, and I thought that's worthwhile to have a look at. So have a look at this next reading from Acts 12. Then Herod went from, so it's King Herod, or one of the kings. Then Herod went from Judea to Caesarea and stayed there a while. He had been quarreling with the people of Tyre and Sidon. Now they joined together and sought an audience with him. Having secured the support of Blastus, a trusted personal servant of the king, they asked for peace because they depended on the king's country for their food supply. On the appointed day, Herod, wearing his royal robe, sat on his throne and delivered a public address to the people. They shouted, "This is the voice of a god, not of a man." Immediately, because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down. He was eaten by worms and died. Now that comes from the Bible. And I guess if you're skeptical, you might look at those types of things and say, yes, whatever you reckon. Okay? You know, this is your typical story. A guy doesn't give praise to God, angel strikes him down. Well, let's have a listen to a source from outside of the Bible, which actually records it in a completely different way, but it records the same event. Again, this is from Josephus. On the second day, Herod put on a garment made wholly of silver and of a contexture truly wonderful, and came into the theatre early in the morning. At that time, the silver of his garment, being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays, shone upon it, shone out after a surprising manner, and so resplendent as to spread a horror over those who looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and one from another, though not for his good, that he was a god. Upon this, the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. A severe pain arose in his belly, and it began in a most violent manner. Accordingly, he was carried into the palace. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed this life. Now, we can't do that for every miracle in the Bible, but for this one, we can. For this one, we can. Now, I've put forward you the evidence for where the Bible lines up with the rest of history. But as I said, because it has so many details, there's a few occasions where it doesn't. And one of these would be at the start of Luke's Gospel, where it talks about a census being made for the whole world, for the Roman world, and also the time at which this happened. Now, I've given you some references where you could follow that up, but the solution to that is actually that there's a number of possible solutions, and we're not sure which one it is. So I'm not trying to say that it always fits in nice and neat, but overwhelmingly it does. Now, from this, we can see that Christianity is not a legend. You know how a legend starts off with Jesus is just a man, and then over time it gradually builds up to become what it is today. What we've got is documents from the first century, and Jesus begins that way. He's not a legend that builds up. There's no evidence of Jesus being a legend. The way he starts is the way that he's finishing in our world today. And it's interesting that secular historians say that Jesus did things his contemporaries viewed as miracles. So non-Christian secular historians will say that that Jesus did things his contemporaries viewed as miracles. They don't want to say they're miracles, but they'll say that that is what people, that is how he was viewed. Okay, the final point I want to look at, and I'll just do this briefly, is do the events which followed the life of Jesus, as it's recorded in the Bible, match what's being claimed? Now, what I mean by that is, in our history, we have the arrival of Captain Cook in the First Fleet. Now, when we say that to people, does that match what happened afterwards? Because if Captain Cook didn't come, then things would be different, wouldn't they? Well, Captain Cook coming does match what happened in that the British flag is now part of our flag in Australia. English is spoken here. You can look at it and say, well, yeah, there's good evidence just from seeing what's happened that someone at least came from England and founded a colony here. We can see that just from looking around us. What about with church history, just general history? What do we find? Well, we actually find that it matches up to what we'd expect if Jesus was claiming the things he claimed and doing the things he did. For instance, the church begins bang at that point in time. The apostles are killed for their testimony. Now, if the apostles were making up this story, then it's harder to imagine that they'd be prepared to die for what they know is false. But the history that we have on the disciples is that nearly all of them die for this testimony, that Jesus died and was raised from the dead. We have all of the letters and the Gospels that we find in the New Testament being written at this time. We have the whole start of the church and a whole new start of literature and writings and theological writings which start from this time. We have a major shift in theology. We go from a big section of the Jewish people thinking that you can't eat pork and you must keep separate from all the nations, to now actually going out to the nations, and that needs to be explained. Now, you may be able to think of other reasons why these things happen, but the Jesus reason actually gives a good explanation and the simplest explanation to all of them. So look, to finish up, if you're skeptical of the history in the Bible, I'd like to invite you to think again. To think of the Bible just from a historical point of view, and to see that there are good reasons for it. I'll finish up with my final quote here from Dr. John Dixon, who's a historian in this area. And he says, "Professional historians, regardless of their religious persuasion, treat the New Testament and its portrait of Christ far more seriously than the general public realizes. There are literally thousands of scholars around the world who devote their time to analysing early Christianity. Some of them hold chairs in the most prestigious universities in the world, and they constantly publish their findings in more than 100 academic journals dedicated to this subject. One reason for the size of this scholarly enterprise, apart from the fact that Christianity has been around for a while, is that the data at the historian's disposal is greater than most of us realize. I'll finish there. Thank you.